Hello, eardrums of the world, and welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio, Tom Rhodes Podcast, Tom Rhodes Power Boost, whatever you want to call it. It's my little internet program. And today is probably the most exotic introduction I've ever recorded. I am on Gwanali Beach in the city of Busan, Korea. I just did shows down here. Great expat scene. The club is called Old 55. There was French people, South Africans, Irish, Canadian, American. Just raucous fun. There's a Jimi Hendrix poster on the back wall of the stage. How can you not bring your very best in front of a big, giant photo of Jimi Hendrix? I had a few days off, and I absolutely fell in love with this beach. It hasn't been ruined yet. Gwanali Beach is this crescent beach. There's seafood shops and coffee shops, and about a half a mile out is this massive bridge. It's not the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. It's not the Sydney Harbor Bridge in Sydney. But you know what? It's a pretty amazing friggin' bridge. And it's straight out across the water. I'm looking out on the Pacific Ocean or the Bay of Japan. But they don't call it the Bay of Japan in Korea because Koreans hate Japanese. They simply call it the East Sea. Anyway, I was in Busan about a year and a half ago, fell in love with it. If you're ever gonna come here, Halloween, the street party is insane. People have funny, cool costumes and drink until the sun comes up. The convenience stores here sell beer 24 hours a day, so it was the greatest street party I've ever seen in my life. Met loads of wonderful people, and that's why I came back. So I had a couple days off, chilling at the beach here, Gwanali Beach. You got to check it out before it gets ruined by beach douchebags and corporate entity bullshit that ruins everything cool. It's this really charming beach. Korean families walking around, people walking dogs, Korean nuns. It's enchanting. Lovely place. Listen, I got to do a heartfelt commercial for this place. It's the reason I came back to Busan. Yes, I met a lot of great people, friends for life, that I couldn't wait to see again. But there's a place here, a restaurant, and it does shabu shabu, which I think is originally a Japanese dish. But like I said, Koreans hate Japanese, and they'd be very offended if you said that. They probably think it's theirs. I tried in Los Angeles to find the best shabu shabu, and whoever is serving it there needs to do a Google search or go to the library. They're obviously not doing it right. This shabu shabu place, it's a communal meal. You're at a table with a big bowl, and it's got water with beef stock in it, and you dump all these vegetables in it, and mushrooms, and slices of meat, or chicken, or fish, whatever you want. I like to throw everything on the table into it. The kimchi, squirt hot sauce into it, and the broth is so insanely good to sip on, even before you get to the delicious little cooked veggies, mushrooms, and beef and stuff. The name is in Korean. I took a couple business cards from them. I'm gonna have to put it somewhere as my travel tips of best things in the world on TomRhodesRadio.com very soon, whenever I can, because the name is in Korean. There's no sense even saying it. But the place is incredible. I'm happy to do a free commercial for these people. And today's guest is probably the best human being you would ever want to share a big bowl of steaming shabu shabu with. Today's guest is Ted Alexandro. I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota last month performing at Acme Comedy Club. And Ted was opening up for Jim Gaffigan at this beautiful old theater in Minneapolis. We got together Saturday afternoon, recorded this. Ted is a guy I have so much respect for, and I love his comedy. It's always very funny insight and opinion on world events. He's got great history, grew up in New York City, Queens, great parents, studied music. His brother's a poet. He actually did a historic thing he'll always be remembered for. In New York City forever, they have only paid you $20 for a set, which is cab fare. And living in the world's most expensive city is insane to only be paid $20 a set. He was the leader of getting that changed, not creating a union, but getting the comedians to act as one in a workforce and protest this, and the money was actually raised, the scale, in New York City. He was heavily involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. It became a big part of his comedy, his passion. I've got nothing but love and respect from this guy, for this guy. And it's my pleasure to present to you now, before I jump on a train and head to Seoul for my shows this weekend, the one and only Mr. Ted Alexandro. Ted Alexandro, ladies and gentlemen. Ted Alexandro. My opinion of you is I think you're one of the most well-rounded human beings in stand-up comedy. Because you're artistic and you come kind of from an artistic background, but also you're like politically active.
Yeah.
So you're like, in my opinion, because most opinions are a lot of comedians, the stereotype is that they're, you know, screwed up people or they've got a lot of dysfunction.
Yeah.
So how did you pull off this well-roundedness?
It's all an illusion. I guess, I don't know, I guess probably my family has a lot to do with it. I'm one of five, everyone's pretty artistic. You know, I have two brothers, two sisters. I have a brother who's a poet, a sister who's an actress. All five of us did like musical theater when we were teenagers and stuff. So I think, you know, it was just around me in the house. As far as the arts goes, I played piano from the time I was about five or six. And then the activism and kind of the political bent, my parents had a lot to do with that. I guess they're somewhat, hippies without the tie-dye. Yeah, they were always kind of politically aware. And, you know, we came from the Catholic tradition of do unto others and take care of the less fortunate. It didn't really go too far beyond that in terms of religious dogma, but it was more just an awareness of your brother and your sister and taking care of your neighbors and, you know, the extended community.
So you're from the good kind of Catholics.
I think so.
Yeah.
It feels that way. Because I don't go to church.
Yeah. I think it's because I grew up Catholic, and then, you know, my family went different ways, and my mom joined the Pentecostal church for a while when I was a late teen. But now we've been to Rome a couple times, and I've gone to the Vatican, and, you know, Pope Francis, it's kind of cool to be Catholic again.
Isn't it great, man? Yeah. This guy's talking trash.
He's great. Like a hippie.
He really is. Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of thing I can respond to, you know? Yeah. Yeah. He's advocating for the least among us, you know, I mean, least in terms of just worldly possessions and stuff like that. Those are the people that need a voice.
That was the whole idea of Christianity in the first place.
Right.
I don't even think they weren't supposed to build churches in the first place.
Right.
That was a waste of money. The church was helping people on the street.
Yeah. I mean, I always respond to, you know, again, it's funny, like you said, I was raised Catholic, and I have a joke about that, how the end of that sentence is never, and now I'm really Catholic. It's always, I was raised Catholic, and now I'm not, you know?
Yeah.
But that said, you know, the Jesus message, that guy, is so compelling as just this guy that went around in sandals, washed people's feet, you know, just that humility of, again, doing for others, you know, that's kind of a compelling message and something that was ingrained in me, I think, through my parents who really embodied it, too. They weren't the type that, you know, I'm always turned off by the religious sort who talk the talk. But, you know, my mom would invite like homeless guys to dinner and stuff. So it was kind of bizarre, really. But it was also, you know, walking the walk in a somewhat extreme sense.
Right. Yeah. They're not the judgmental kind of Christian.
Not at all. Yeah. Yeah. Very much about inclusiveness, you know. And I have a theory. What do you think about? I think there's a lot of comedians who came from a religious tradition in some sense, you know, whether it's Kinison or Hicks or, you know, a lot of folks that in a sense, we kind of just go a different direction. We're kind of like preaching in a sense, but it's not, it's like the church of, you know, absurdity or the church of ideas or, you know, it's rooted in that same sense of like a passionate desire to communicate something. but not taking anything too seriously.
Well, I think for me personally, preachers have been a huge influence on my style. And my mother's always had the religious, my mom's a real Jesus freak. Mm-hmm. And she still to this day always has the religious channel on all day on the television.
Nice.
And in the 80s, my mom loved Jimmy Swaggart. Mm-hmm. And before, you know, his sex scandals and everything, he was untouchable and he was a mesmerizing preacher. And I talked to Steve Hicks, Bill Hicks' brother, about this, that I think Jimmy Swaggart influenced some of Bill Hicks' style, the way he would prowl the stage like a panther.
And, sure.
So I think your observation is absolutely correct.
Chris Rock, right? Wasn't his grandfather a preacher as well?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I think the rhythms of like that character, you know, because I'm sure you've seen Chris, you know, like when you see him working stuff out in the small New York clubs, it's very stripped down and kind of he's just working ideas out.
Right, I've seen him sit on a stool and just read off a notebook.
That's right.
The same material that 2-3 years later, he's the fire-breathing dragon on stage.
That's right. Yeah, so then he adds that layer of kind of like the preacher or, you know, whatever you want to call it, that cadence that is...
Like really hitting consonants and stretching vowels. I love that kind of like jazz speak, you know?
Yeah, there's a definite musicality to it.
For some reason, this popped in my head, and I just feel compelled to tell you. When my parents got divorced, and my mother was having a hard time selling the house, there was a black woman at the church, and my mom told her, you know, they prayed on it, like you pray on everything. And the woman said, I think I know someone would be interested in your house. And they came over. And this woman had like 6 kids, and it was another black woman that came over and her kids, and they're running around the front yard. And my mom said to her at the end, you know, do you think they would be interested in your house? And the woman goes, oh, honey, we don't have money to buy your house. And my mom goes, well, why are you here? And she goes, just wait. And about a month later, the house was sold because someone in the neighborhood saw all these black kids running around the yard. Somebody in the neighborhood organized.
That's great. That's one way of clearing
it. So, you know, racism can be effective.
It can be very effective, yeah. Yeah, when used properly.
Yeah.
It can really motivate.
But now you come, I mean, like, that's interesting. Your brother's a poet. I mean, does he make money at that?
No.
Does he go around New York and all the like the poetry slam type things?
He goes to open mics and those types of things. But he's very, you know, he works as a security guard at a school, at the UN school in Queens. And it's, he really has this like lovely presence. He has his degree in education. But then, you know, went through some jobs, decided didn't want to teach, was doing tutoring on the side, stuff like that. Eventually found himself in security, but is a poet, you know? So he had this, like a fourth grade teacher who I think he wrote a poem about the school or about maybe her class specifically. I forget what it was, but the teacher so loved the poem that she said, will you come in and teach a unit on poetry to my class? So he did, and the kids loved it, and this girl has, this, you know, fourth grade girl in the class has continued to write poetry and shows it to my brother and stuff like this. But then the principal got wind that the security guard taught a lesson, and she, you know, ixnayed it, like, we can't have a security guard teaching the kids. So, you know, that to me just it kind of embodied like the way I see my brother and a lot of people in the arts in general that are like these artists, these, you know, poetic souls that are giving stuff away because they want to communicate or they want to help and scrapping by to make ends meet doing whatever job they do, right? Not something that they love. He doesn't love being a security guard, but yet his work so moved this teacher that she invited him into the classroom. You know, who invites a security guard to teach a unit on poetry?
Right.
But then the administration like squashes it. So I mean, there was a lot of metaphors in that for me.
The naysayers that get in the way of every artistic-minded person?
Yeah, yeah, because it's not the right package, or it's not the right, you know, or they're covering their own ass for whatever reason. Yeah, but to answer your question, he is, you know, he's just an artist through and through. Yeah, and my sister, who's an actress, you know, and yeah, just I'm lucky to have people who speak the language of the arts.
Well, you seem really close with your family. I saw that thing you tweeted the other day about National Sibling Day, and I'm like, wow, who celebrates National Sibling Day?
I don't think I tweeted. If I did, I was probably making fun of it.
Okay. Oh my God, this guy is really serious.
No. I mean, I love my brothers and sisters, but no, I would not participate in
some kind of fate. Okay. Yeah. I was like, wow. Maybe he celebrates Flag Day, too. I mean, this guy is like.
That is very important to us.
He embraces the more obscure holidays. So you grew up with kind of, you know, right minded Christian hippie parents who taught you to shake your fist at the man?
Yeah, yeah. Just good people that, in my opinion, advocated for the right things. Because, you know, my dad was an elementary school teacher in Brooklyn, in Bushwick, for 30 years. My mom was a stay-at-home mom for most of our childhood until my youngest sibling was in high school. And then she taught as well. And they both taught in poor communities, you know. So they were very much about service. You know, had opportunities to leave and make more money and go to greener pastures and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, I think they imbued us all with a sense of, you know, values that money is not everything, possessions, like the worldly kind of things. Not that those things are bad, but, you know, think about what's motivating you. You know, think about, like, why you're doing what you're doing.
Personal happiness over being a money-loving whore.
I think so. That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And it seems like education was pretty valued in your family, too. So you became a music teacher?
Yeah, you know, when I went to college at City College of New York, I was a jazz piano major. And, you know, I had played piano.
Did everyone in your family choose a profession that would pay absolutely no money?
That's another theme.
Your parents taught you too well not That's to follow right. the path of money.
That's right. They wanted to ensure that we would live a life of poverty and struggle.
That's pretty sexy, man. I mean, that's like I'm saying, you're like such a well-rounded, artsy guy. You know, I mean, and if that wasn't enough, you're politically active. I mean, why? I mean, that being a jazz pianist, I mean.
Well, I studied jazz piano. Okay. I was not a jazz pianist. I quickly learned.
Because I'm picturing you walking around Queens with tails and white gloves. You know, you don't want to hurt your hands type of thing.
I did do that, but
you can't open doors.
Yeah, somebody please get that for me. No, I, you know, I loved jazz, but I was kind of, it was almost like a language that I was late coming to, you know, like you have to grow up speaking a language to really master it. And I was, all of a sudden I was immersed in jazz as a freshman in college. You know, I was familiar with it in passing. I had listened to it and I was a fan, in a broad sense, but all of a sudden, you know, you had to choose the classical track or the jazz track. So I was like, well, I don't like classical really. So I'll be a jazz major. So all of a sudden I was really in deep and in over my head really. But I would practice for like 8 hours a day, you know, for over 2 or 3 years. And, you know, I gave it my best shot and I learned a lot. And I think I learned a lot of things that in later years applied to my comedy and to my work ethic and my approach. Yeah, so it was like, I think by working so hard at something that didn't come that easily, I eventually, when I found comedy, you know, and it came more easily, I had a work ethic in place.
I always call it, like, when I do, rarely, when I, you know, when I'm not headlining, when I do a set and I go up and it's a certain situation where I'm just feeling it, and I'm just playing, just doing jokes that are coming to me. I mean, I always call that like a jazz set.
Yeah.
You know, did that help your comedy at all? The way, like, doing without structure and just feeling it?
It did. I think it took years for that to kind of become part of my process. Because I was pretty heavily written in the early years of my stand-up. But like you said, as I got more comfortable and found my voice and trusted myself more, now it is part of my process to leave. It's like, you know, jazz is essentially like knowing structure so well that you can then abandon it, you know, and I think that's kind of where I'm at now, where I'll work things out on stage and just have an idea for a story or something, you know, and I opened for Louis for a while, Louis C.K., and I learned from him that kind of approach of start with something that you want to talk about, something that you're really compelled to talk about that's weird or interesting, because the crowd's going to listen differently when you're talking about something that matters to you as opposed to when they're listening for, this is clearly a joke, okay, where's it going, where's the, you know, they listen differently than when you're talking about something that you mean.
So you mean like something, an idea that's not fully worked out?
Yeah. So I think in recent years, like say the last 5, 6, I've given myself a much more leeway to do what you're talking about, like with those sets where you meander and don't really have the landing point. Or maybe you have the landing point, but you don't have all the beats leading up to it. You kind of know where you're going, but you have to figure it out. And I'm much more willing to do that in front of an audience now.
Well, I think that's a brilliant comparison that, you know, you, as a jazz musician, you have to know structure so well that you can then abandon it. Because I always say, like, it's really exciting when a comedian gets confident. Because when everybody starts out the same, you know, you're awkward, you're terrified. And then, like, some guys it's, you know, 5-year mark, some guys it takes them 10. But, like, when somebody gets confident enough to abandon your jokes and speak extemporaneously or off the cuff, and just deal with whatever chaos happens in the room. I mean, it's pretty exciting when a comedian gets confidence.
You're right. And you never know when that's going to happen, right? But you just see a guy and
one day, boom, it just happens. You're on stage and you realize, oh, fuck, I'm not terrified.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it's a process. But yeah, there is something. I always feel like I was talking about it last night with Jim Gaffigan. We were saying, like, you spend your 20s and 30s learning, as a comic, learning how to tell a joke, learning how to be funny, learning why you're funny. Once you're in your 40s, like, you're a man now. You have life experience. You have things to say. You've lived. You've failed. Like you said, you're confident, you know, because you have all that experience. So it's almost like now you have all those tools, but you also have something to say, you know? So I think 40s and 50s are like really the time, you know, it's like it's an exciting, interesting time because, you know, like what do you have to talk about in your 20s? You know, not to say that those guys can't be funny, but there's just more meat to get into.
Right. Pain and life experience to draw from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is there any jazz that you still listen to and need religiously?
Yeah, all the time, man. I mean, you know, as a pianist, I love guys like Hank Jones, McCoy Tyner, Thelonious Monk. I mean, you know, the list is long of piano guys. Teddy Wilson going back. But, you know, Miles Davis Kind of Blue is, of course, like, you know, the bellwether of jazz albums that I always have in my car or whatever. There's loads, man. You know, yeah, loads of stuff that, you know, I think as an artist, like, I like to have an artistic diet of stuff that challenges me. You know what I mean? Like, because there's so much accessible pop crap, even when you're walking through the lobby of whatever, you're bombarded with it. And you hear it and you absorb it, and that just becomes part of your, you know, like, we don't do things that are hard, you know, like we don't listen to music that is hard to listen to. We don't read things that are like you have to reread, you know what I mean? So all of these things that are just easily digestible and kind of ephemeral that come and go, like that's nice. It's nice to have ice cream and pizza, but sometimes you have to like dig in and you know, and I think as an artist, all that stuff feeds you too.
Yeah. The fact that you taught music in school, is there anything, technique as a teacher, teaching music or just being a teacher, that you used as a comedian?
Well, you were a teacher too, right? I remember you.
Well, in school on television.
Oh, you didn't actually teach.
No.
Oh, okay. I thought that was based on.
Now you don't like me anymore. You thought we had this teacher.
No, I like you more. I like you more. I respect you more.
You thought we had this teacher bond. I get it. I had on the sitcom, I played an English teacher in a prep school.
Yeah.
It was like Dead Poets Society.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But I never taught.
You never did, okay. Yeah, I taught for 5 years. You know, when jazz piano became too much, I switched my major to education, and I wound up teaching elementary school music for 5 years in New York City public schools. And to answer your question, absolutely. I think in a lot of ways, the public speaking muscle was worked heavily in those 5 years because I was in front of large groups. You know, because schools are like cutting the arts program so much, I was only there like 3 days a week instead of five, but I would still basically see the whole school in those 3 days. So I would have groups of, 50, groups of 80, sometimes 100. So I was performing, it was like, you have to be interesting, you have to keep their attention, you have to be compelling. I think I learned a lot by being in front of groups of kids who are easily distracted.
Crowd control.
Yeah.
Chaos control.
Absolutely.
Command of an audience.
And be a little crazy sometimes, which helps in stand-up too, where you just like, you get their attention because you do something kind of fucked up, or you take a left turn that, because like if you're just speaking, people fall into this trance of just like, especially in school where they're throwing information. It's easy to fall into this, all right, taking notes. But if you do something weird or, just something to like, hey, we're all here, let's lock in. Like something to just keep them in your energy and keep everybody, So I think I learned that from teaching too, of the need to keep people off balance sometimes.
So is that where the you got the inspiration for, is it called Teacher's Lounge, your web series? I just saw the first episode.
Yeah. That had a big part of it, yeah. In the web series that I co-wrote with my writing partner, Hollis James, I play the music teacher, he plays the janitor, we're always just hanging out in the teacher's lounge, and then other comedians come in playing faculty. So we got Lewis Black as the principal, Judy Gold is the gym teacher, Janine Garofalo makes the public address announcements, Judah Friedlander's computer science. So yeah, it's
and you got them all to do this for no money.
Isn't that the way?
That's beautiful.
Just like my parents taught me. So we shot the first four. We put our money into it, and now we got this company, Snag Films, that's giving us some funding for the next six episodes. So that was a victory.
It's beautifully shot. Yeah. I'm beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, we're excited about it. And we just want it to be kind of this continuous thing where we can keep bringing comics in, So we think it has legs and we're excited about it. And hopefully now we, disappoint my parents and start to make a little money.
That's the new paradigm, is doing everything on your own on YouTube. So,
yeah.
I mean, this epoch was certainly tailor-made for you and your family plan of action.
That's right.
Because I always say I'm the king of free content.
Oh, man.
I make these videos for YouTube, put a lot of money into it, and I don't have any commercials on the podcast, and it's like, putting things out for free.
Yeah. I mean, there is something, I go back and forth. There is something beautiful about, here's my offering. I when I put out my new special, I made it pay what you want.
I wanted to ask you that. Yeah, that is exactly what we're talking about. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of like the honor system when when you'd see like some snacks and there'd be like a bucket. And,
exactly.
that system never worked, right? You don't see the honor system snack tray anymore.
That's right. But I always loved that. Whether it was like the snack tray or like a bookstore or, places that after they closed up would leave whatever it was, leave their wares out front and say, please leave whatever you want. I love that. I love that spirit. So for my special, I decided to go that route, and it's worked out great. People have paid above, the average special now is like $5. That's what like Louis and Jim and Aziz and these guys have, you know, that the ones that have made their special available for direct download on their sites. It was pretty much like a $5 market. But people have been paying an average of like $6.10, I think, is the average.
Oh, that's good.
For mine, yeah.
Because I think that $5 price kind of screwed it for everybody else. Because yeah. if you're Louis C.K. and you got millions of fans,
that's right.
at $5 a pop is great.
That's right.
But, you know,
sure.
some of the guys who aren't as big, you know, like myself, that program's not going to work too well.
Yeah.
No. So it's okay with the, it's not... Everyone's doing 99 cents, the bare minimum, to get the special.
No, and I think it works out better because you get the folks that maybe aren't fans or haven't heard of you that are willing to take a shot. All right, I'll check it out for 99 cents or
right.
$2 or whatever they pay. But then you get fans of yours who pay 10 bucks or, you know, or north of that. I had one guy who I didn't know paid 50, you know, so you get those surprises on both ends, you know. And it goes back to that thing of ultimately you just want people to hear what you do.
Right.
You know? So yeah, there is that element of trust. And also it's an interesting kind of engagement with, I hate to say the consumer, but it's an engagement with this person who likes your work or wants to hear it to say, yeah, you decide. You know? I mean, on the low end, 99 cents because I don't want to take a loss on it. But anything up from 99 cents?
I think it's a brilliant idea, especially, you know, for someone like you. I think you're very visible, you know. You've been in Louis episodes. You've done pretty much all the late night talk shows. So, I mean, like somebody going, oh, wow, I really like that guy on Conan. I'm going to look him up online. And then, boom, wow, here's a special. Fucking yeah. 99 cents.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's who I am. I think I'm that guy that, like, oh, I think I saw him on Comedy Central. I saw... him on that guy was funny on Conan, you know. I mean, I have people who know me, but in the broader sense, I think I am that guy that, like, you know, not a household name by any stretch. So it is good to have something available that when people go, they're like, oh man, you know, yeah, I'll pay 99 cents, I'll pay $5, I'll pay, you know, whatever. So yeah, it's another, you know what it is, I think there are so many like unexamined decisions in our path as comedians where we just do what the next thing is, right?
Right.
What your manager...
And now is the new way. I mean, we're kind of... Everybody's feeling their way and inventing it as we go along with all this new media and technology to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you stamp it with each of those little decisions that you make, you stamp it a little more individually that it's you, you know? So... with the pay what you will, even with the language that I put on the site, I just tried to make it like, don't just hand everything over and say like, yeah, I'll show up the night of the taping and that'll be my involvement in my special.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, the thing about your style that I love the most is, you know, they say likability is 90%. I mean, your likability is 1,000%, you know? you really seem like you're speaking to a friend. That's the best way I would describe your style. And even your dirty jokes sound clean.
Yeah.
Like I saw this thing you did. I'm looking at your clips yesterday, last couple days. And you did the thing about gay marriage, about if I book a flight to Vagina and there's a stopover in man's ass...
okay.
I mean,
okay.
That is filthy. That joke is, I'm like, number one, my first thought as a comedian is, that's brilliant. That is an absolute, probably the best observation on a gay marriage joke that I've heard. And then my second thought was, I can't believe he got away with this on network television. Because my dad would always say, my dad loved comedy and, you know, why we would watch the late night talk shows. And I remember when someone would do something risque, my dad would go, wow, I remember when you couldn't. You had to say water closet. You couldn't say toilet on television.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I think I do get away with some stuff, you know, because people don't think of me as a dirty comic or necessarily as an edgy comic. But I have, yeah, like you say, I do. I have plenty of stuff that I have a joke about abortion where I talk about war. And I say, you know, war is difficult because we send people over that we care about, people that we love. Which is why I think we should ban abortion and then raise those babies as our military. You know, nobody gives a shit about them. 20 years later, the mother gets a telegram. Remember that abortion you wanted? Done. God bless America. You know, so, I mean,
I applaud you, sir. That is brilliant.
And that's, you know, that joke is neither pro or anti-abortion. It's really just the exploration of ideas and priorities and the way we think about things, you know? So I try not to be too heavy-handed in my political, like, I don't want to ever be preachy.
Right.
But I want to be like, have you thought about it like this? You know? So, yeah, but I think you're right. I do get away with stuff that maybe, you know, if I was the dirty guy or the shock guy, maybe it wouldn't fly.
Right. I mean, that's a brilliant technique to you know, talk about these. Because, like, usually like, people hear those hot-button words like abortion.
Yes.
And they're instantly turned off.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is a brilliant observation.
Thanks.
So what about your political activism? I mean, the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
You were heavily involved in that.
I was. I still am.
Was that just like the perfect moment happening in time and you were...
It was. It really was. It was not premeditated by me or I think really too many others.
You weren't looking for a protest, I guess is what I'm saying.
No. I wasn't an activist. Yeah, I had the only activism I had really engaged in was I started the New York Comedians Coalition with Russ Meneve, a couple other guys, where we got the pay raised for New York comics.
Right, which for people who don't know, the New York clubs, they paid you taxi fare.
Yeah.
I lived in New York a couple times. It's the most expensive city in the world.
Right.
And you're doing a set. It's sold out. They got all the drinks are $15 each.
Yeah.
And they hand you a $20 bill when you get off stage.
That's right. That's right.
So you had to face being blackballed.
Yes.
Being driven from the industry like any kind of union organizer throughout American history.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it raised? Like $5?
During the week, it went from 20 to 25. On the weekend, over like an 8-year period, it went from $50 to now it's on the high end, $85 to $100.
I have to shake your hand for that. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You risked your entire career for that.
You know, it was...
Could have been.
Again, it was one of those things that I was just compelled to do. I was at a stage where, like, I don't care what the risks are because the rewards are greater and it's important to me. And also it was in the air. You know, like what you're talking about with the Occupy movement. It was in the air, and it was just the right time to do it. And I'm as proud of that, the New York Comedians Coalition. I'm as proud of that as anything really in my career, because it was this collective effort.
You should be. I mean, that's historic. I mean, you know, if you never do anything else in your career, you will forever be remembered.
Yeah, no, thanks.
That. I mean, because that, I don't think people realize, was the equivalent of moving a mountain.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of work. It really was. But you
and
know,
the LA clubs still pay you nothing.
That's right.
So, I mean, as minuscule as getting a $20 for a set in New York, the LA clubs don't even pay you a dime.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, it's... You know, there's still work to be done, but it was nice to see that progress can be made, you know. But to speak to the Occupy movement, I read about it in the paper that this group of activists was sleeping at this park on Wall Street. And I was fascinated by it. So I went down a couple days later. It just blew me away. It blew me away that here's a group of people that are just setting up tents and sleeping there to say we don't agree with this kind of co-opting of our government and of the, you know, like just corporate takeover of really every aspect of life, you know. I think even people that weren't politically savvy or people that couldn't maybe even put it into words everyone feels it from one sense or another, whether it's student debt or, you know, a mortgage that's underwater or a pension that's taken away or people that are fired or people that can't find work or taking work that is lower paid than, you know, like people, I have friends in their 50s that are doing like temp work. You know, they're like, I never thought I'd be in my 50s like doing temp work. I don't have a career. I thought I'd have a career. So yeah, just, I think it's in the air in a lot of different ways. So to answer your question, it was just a visceral sense when I was in that space that these people are talking about the right things, you know, and they're not doing it for money. They're not doing it for fame. They're just, you know, I mean, who does that? Who sets up tents in a park on Wall Street to say enough is enough, you know? So I was like, oh man, this is badass. So I just kept going back. And yeah, it was powerful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like you're saying, I mean, the climate and just our system is so fucking wrong. We're like, majority of our population are indentured servants, start coming out of the start gate because of student loans. And then there's just so many, you know, economic traps of modern living that
sure.
Unless you're born in a rich family, you know, you don't have much chance at a happy life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So to me,
so it seemed like your family, that must have been the greatest time in.
It was like our Woodstock.
Yeah. All families down there protesting and yeah. spray painting, right. you know, Morgan Stanley.
Our
buildings.
Moment finally arrived. Yeah. You know, to me, it was as much about the message as like the community, too. You know, just being down there, talking to folks, hearing people's stories.
What were the greatest moments? I thought it was interesting, you know, how they had to keep changing the tactics of, you know, first the police and everything, they're trying to, you know, say people couldn't camp
yeah.
or the different ways they tried to control it. And then there couldn't be megaphones. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then the people started doing that repeat chant mm-hmm. thing. I thought it was
people's microphone.
It was a clever evolution of tactics, the way that the police and the city kept trying to control and squelch the whole movement.
It really was, yeah. It was pretty brilliant, you know, because it was a peaceful movement, but there was police violence on the other end. So, like you say, there were shifts in tactic and shifts in, you know, ways of approaching, ways of getting a message out. But, you know, again, it's to me, it's just fascinating how a group of folks started sleeping in a park and it became this national and even global movement that the corporate media could not ignore. And that's exactly what they want to ignore. That, you know, that's, they don't want to talk about income inequality or, you know, certain debt, you know, debt slaves and, you know, this type of thing. It's the last thing they want to talk about. But yet it became this national conversation that really impacted probably the presidential race. It probably, you know, it impacted so many facets of the national conversation. And when people say to me, like, well, what did it accomplish? I always take it back to me on the personal level. What I did was I took my money out of Bank of America, out of TD Bank, and put it into Actors Federal Credit Union. I joined a credit union. Which, you know, you're a member rather than there's a corporate board of directors that does whatever they want with your money. So just more of an active decision.
What is the benefit of that? Explain that to me.
A credit union is one member, one vote, rather than a corporate board of directors that kind of decides where money's going to be invested or, you know, like you don't really have a say. Your money could be in diamond mines in South Africa or whatever, you know. But with a credit union, you have a vote in where money is invested. It's kept local for the most part, which is what banks are supposed to do, you know, kind of keep money locally, invest it locally into local businesses, make it accessible for loans, affordable loans, all this type of stuff. So that was one big step for me. Taking my money out of big banks, putting it locally into a credit union. Another thing was getting money out of the stock market. I didn't have a lot, but I was like, I don't want to participate in that. Getting rid of my cable and my newspaper subscription. Just kind of, again, my media diet. Like, what do I want in my life? So, you know, those are things that I did. Another thing is we started Occupy Astoria in my neighborhood, and that's still going on. We're opening a community space that will have a library and arts and activities for kids and speakers, and we're in the process of turning this little warehouse into a community space. So that's 2 years after the Occupy movement. You know, these types of things are still going on, but you don't read about them.
You're going to inspire me to move to Astoria, Queens.
It's a great place, man.
That's brilliant. I never considered the, you know, like credit union option versus big monolith bank.
Read about it. A lot of people don't, but yet it's I did my research. I read about it. I saw what was available to me. But it just made more sense. Again, it's like those unexamined decisions that we, you know, it's very easy to make in life. Just a little bit of reading, a little bit of thought can kind of.
What other knowledge did you gain or personal experiences? Because I remember when it was happening, seeing your posts on Twitter and Facebook, I was like, wow, you know, Ted is, he really rolled up his sleeves and got, you know, knee deep in this. And I can't think of any other comedian who did.
There were a bunch down there, but yeah, I was definitely in it. And it wasn't premeditated. It, like I said, it was just a visceral reaction to what I saw. And I think it was just this pent up like response to, I think aside from the political aspect of the things that we're talking about, it was just the human thing of reclaiming the public space too, right? The parks, like we can't even get together and just where can we go that isn't like approved by corporations,
designated like, riot area.
That's right. You know, we can't even get together in a park and exchange ideas without riot police arriving. And you know, I got hit in the kidneys with a baton.
Wow.
One time when they were clearing the park, they told us to go across the street, which I did. Then they followed us across the street and started, you know.
Yeah, that was cute how the cops were pepper spraying collegiate, you know, white kids.
It was really fascinating, man. But you know, that helped grow the movement. That's what made it national, really. That pepper spray thing, and then the I think it was like 700 arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge. It made me a student in that I went back and I read, and also conversations with so many people that had been through this before, that this is not new. This is kind of the playbook of how you squash unrest, you know?
I liked it. I mean, you know, it wasn't, you know, what people, the media tried to portray it at the beginning, like, you know, just some disgruntled hippies. It wasn't. It was, you know, educated people who, you know, feel like cogs in the system, and nothing is ever going to change unless we speak out right now.
Yeah.
And I liked what Russell Brand said, that the Occupy movement was important, if only for the fact that it made the entire world aware that there was a 1%.
Yeah.
I mean, if nothing else, I don't think people even realize that.
Yeah, absolutely. He's been saying a lot of great stuff too. Yeah. And you know, I think it's indicative of where we're at, that like a comedian of that stature, is using his platform to talk about these things, right? It's pretty fascinating.
I think you're the Jesus of stand-up comedy, Jeff. But also, I think, you know, you've...
Kill me now.
You've lived through... Okay, let's choose a different biblical person so you can stick around. you've lived through... You know, just by being a New Yorker, and you've lived through some huge historical moments, like the Occupy movement. Yep. You were obviously there for September 11th. Just as a New Yorker, what was that climate like in the comedy world? Because there's always the too soon thing.
Yeah.
And I know Louis C.K. got a lot of credit for his... he masturbated between the Twin Towers going down. But I don't know how long it was until he made that joke. What was that period like in comedy in New York?
That was pretty wild and pretty unique. You know, personally, I had just gotten back from Europe. I was on vacation with a couple of buddies, and we were in Amsterdam. We were in Germany. I think maybe in Ireland. Yeah. So I had just gotten back like the day before. And then, you know, that Tuesday was when the towers were hit. So it was really surreal, and, you know, it turns your whole world upside down, because especially when the messages that you're getting are the terrorists attacked us, and, you know, this public enemy number one, Bin Laden, and all this, you know, like you're trying to absorb everything, and you're also trying to grieve, you know, like you're grieving that your city was attacked, that people died. So yeah, it's just this chaotic time, but people come together. There were comedians that actually, this comedian Joe DeVito organized a show, you know, like maybe 2 or 3 weeks in, when all of the first responders and cops, firemen, EMTs were working round the clock down there, just looking for survivors or
to do a show for these guys.
To do a show for them. So we did it. Yeah, there was like, you know, because everything shut down there. So there were like restaurants that were just kind of triage centers.
Well, I lived down there, 98, 99. There wasn't anything down there.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know.
I'm sorry to cut you off with my bad joke. It was only, I lived in the Wall Street area, 98, 99. And the only place that was open at night, late at night, was a 24-hour porno shop.
Yeah,
and I would go in there and go 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you have any edible underwear? I'm starving. There's nothing to eat. Anyway, sorry to derail your.
No, but yeah, that's kind of like what it was, though. It was like a ghost town.
Yeah.
So this comedian organized a show, and it was one of those like bizarre things, and you even wondered like, is this even appropriate? But obviously, they wanted it because they're just there all the time, like, you know, doing this. This awful kind of, but at the same time, beautiful work that they're doing down there. Everyone wanted to contribute, like, in whatever way they could. So, yeah, that was one element that I always remember, like, doing that show, like, that was very weird, but everyone was so appreciative. But comedically, yeah, it took, you know, probably weeks and months, and it was an ongoing process of, you know, I remember Geraldo did a great bit about seeing, like, a bachelorette party with, like, you know, dildos on their head or whatever, and he knew that we were back to like we were gonna be okay, you know, that kind of thing, and like how these drunk bachelorettes were like, we're not gonna let those Mexicans stop us or whatever, you know? So you would just watch guys and it would inspire you, you know, like every single one was like a just like an inspiration, like, okay, this guy's talking about it. This guy, you know, made that joke, you know. So there was a lot of that going around, you know, because it was, but I also remember, like, when people first came back to the clubs, because initially it was, you know, again, it was a ghost town. The clubs may have shut down for, I don't know, a couple days. But then when people started coming out, they were so starved.
Ready to laugh. Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah. Just wanted to be together, you know. It went beyond. You killed, like, in ways that you never killed, because people were just so happy to be out of their house, not watching the news. Yeah, it was really surreal. It was kind of beyond the jokes. It was a communal kind of healing in a way.
It's beautiful, man. That's great that you lived through that and experienced all that, you know? Yeah. 'Cause I always wondered what the scene was like. I was back in New York in December to do this new Dave Attell Comedy Central series.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hadn't been to New York since the last time I saw you, when I did Gotham with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think was 4 years ago.
Probably, yeah.
5 years ago, because my wife and I were only together for like a year or two at that point.
Yeah.
I really was inspired this last visit to New York in December. There seems to be a comedy renaissance happening now.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many young comics moving there. You got all these new stages, like the UCB Theater there. There's that other club in the Village. I forget, the Stand or something.
Yep.
I forget what it's called.
The Stand, Eastville.
And there just seems to be like this new excitement, like a renaissance. Damn. Happening. And then now you got all these late night talk shows there and stuff. So it seems like a very viable option for a young comedian to move there. You know.
Yes and no. I mean, there's more comics there. So I think if you're starting out, it's probably tough, because a lot of comics have done exactly what you're saying. They've moved there. And there's as far as number of comedians and quality of comedians, I think it's a boom. You know, it's never been better. The scene is so vibrant. But, you know, it's probably tough to make a living, tough to get stage time. That's why there's so many of these alternative rooms, bars, you know, restaurants, laundromats, you know, there's all the shows all over the place. But it's great. And now there's a real cross-pollination of, you know, when I came up, it was the clubs. It was the clubs. You were a club comic. And then, you know, the alternative scene was kind of birthed in, like, I guess the mid-90s or who knows, maybe even early. But now it's a thing. And now the alt scene and the club scene exist side by side, and you go back and forth. And that has been a great thing for me comedically, because I would do things in the alt scene that I wouldn't do in the clubs and vice versa. But over the years, now I do the same bits in both. So my style has evolved thanks to, you know, this kind of surge in like a different style of comedy and different types of rooms that were maybe a little more jazzy, like you said. You know, like, people are listening, they're open to ideas, they're open to experimentation. So yeah, all of that has been great for me personally, and I think great for comedy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you are one of the godfathers of the scene, because, I mean, you're such a stalwart of the New York comedy scene. But, and first of all, anyone who's listening, I do not recommend anyone moving there before you're ready.
Oh, yeah.
Because I moved to New York when I was 20.
Is that right?
And I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And I could only afford to live in Washington Heights. And it was the worst year of my life.
Wow.
But the renaissance that I'm talking about, you know, like, you know, you mentioned the club era versus, like, the blend of the alternative scene now. A long time ago, and I think maybe even before you started, I think you started in like 94-ish.
Early 90s, yeah.
There was and I moved to New York, well, when I was 20, so that was like 87. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this certain style of New York kind of hack comedian.
Yeah, sure.
That did a lot of crowd work. And I always tell this story about, I was at this club, I forget where it was, it might have been the Comic Strip. And, you know, so the comedian wasn't watching the other comedians before him. And he goes on stage, hey, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do? And this guy just goes, look, I'm a plumber. He's a dentist. He's from Cleveland. He's from Pittsburgh. Tell us a fucking joke. It's like, so, like, it seems like that old New York style has evaporated, thankfully. And that there is a lot of really inventive stuff. And I think that's what I mean by youth. And it doesn't have to be just a youthful person doing it. It right. seems like there's really exciting comedy happening there now.
Definitely, definitely. And for me, for a long time, there was a disconnect between what comedy is and the way comedy is marketed. It's still marketed in this antiquated, jokey 80s, like, are you guys ready to laugh? Come on, put your laugh faces on. You know, like, just this kind of bombardment of goofiness.
Right. And,
like, comedy is an art, man, and it's, you know, and not in a highfalutin way, but can't we set it up to, like, you know, you don't go to a music thing and they're like, are you guys ready to, you know, it's just like, you just let the people hear it and react the way they want to react. Don't have this chuckly 80s kind of
sticky,
yeah,
guy with a polyester jacket,
yeah. It's so dead, and comedy is not really that anymore, and that can still be funny, you know, not to discount, I mean, you know, there's the whole range is great, I love it all, but, you know, can't we catch up with the evolution a little bit, you know? So, you know, that's something that I think needs to happen. Comedy clubs need to grow up in their marketing of the product.
I'm glad you say that. And as a jazz man, at your core, I feel compelled to also tell you, my personal theory is that Mark Twain was the very first stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
He invented the genre with his first live speaking lectures in San Francisco. And in England, stand-up comedy, before the Comedy Store opened in 1979, was more like kind of pub comedians doing like racist stuff and mother-in-law jokes.
Right.
Stand-up comedy is a unique, original American art form like jazz. I think it's probably the only two art forms that we can claim as our own.
You're probably right. Yeah. Yeah. And at the root of it is free speech and democracy, right? Because, like, I've heard the Marsalis brothers talk about jazz as democracy, the democratic combining of this person shines, this group, they meld their talents for this something that becomes a singular expression, then this person solos, you know, so it's like that democratic, like the best of the mix. And I think with comedy, it's the same because it's a collaborative thing with the crowd. You know, I'm always like not stunned, but aware, very much aware that it's a collaborative art form. You know, we're on stage alone, but yet the way people laugh, the rhythm of a joke, it's a collaborative thing. You know, we don't try our stuff out in an empty room. You know, we don't record our specials in empty rooms. You need people there, you know? So it's that democratic kind of collaborative thing in what we do too. You know, that the masses edit for us. They say, yes, that's it. That stays in. No, that's out. No, keep working on that. You know, it's a collaborative kind of genesis of how we create.
Brilliant. How do you think being a New Yorker has infused your comedy, for better or for worse?
I think it's in me. It's who I am, you know. When I started...
And again, you're someone like the stereotypical New Yorker. Like, you're saying that comedy should be remarketed. I mean, like, you always think it's like, you know, New Yorkers are like really tough kind of, you know, ball busters. And you're not that guy at all.
No. Well, you know, I'm grateful to comedy that it took me out of Queens and it took me out of New York. Because when I started, I was a Queens guy. You know, I hadn't traveled much. Went to school in New York. But comedy took me around the country, around the world, so that it gave me an education that I think I was really starving for, you know, just to be amongst different types of people, different cultures. So I learned, you know, I learned to become a citizen of the world, which is what I think I always wanted and probably what my parents raised us to be. But I was just kind of stuck in Queens for 20 years. So yeah, I'm really grateful for comedy being my passport kind of to a larger existence.
I know you've done a lot of worldwide gigs too.
Yeah.
What's the most unique, wild, wonderful knowledge nuggets, experiences you've gained from that?
You know, I've been all over the place. I did the Axis of Evil tour.
Did you really?
Yeah, Maz Jobrani and Ahmed Ahmed and those guys. You know, they're so big in the Middle East that they started bringing American guys over. So I think maybe it was Dean Obadala first contacted me and said, do you want to come over for the Jordan Comedy Festival? Which I'm like, there's a Jordan Comedy Festival. So I did that. And it was just this great education of performing in front of an Arab crowd. And I was you know, kind of freaking out, saying to Dean, like, Is this show going to work? Are they going to get this? He's like, just do your act. He just kept saying, and I didn't know if he said that because he wanted to see me bomb or if it was going to work.
He's in on this. They're tricking me.
Right. Watch what happens. But yeah, it went really well. You know, it was this crowd of, you know, and I'm sure your experience is the same of how the rest of the world is so much more familiar with American culture, American politics than we are of theirs. But yeah, it felt like a set kind of almost anywhere else after a while.
I'm so glad I remembered this question. Something I find remarkable about your personal history.
Yeah, here we go.
Is you opened up for Chuck Berry and Smokey Robinson.
Oh, man.
Because, you know, and I mentioned it to my wife, and she goes, oh, he's not that old. And I, well, no, because, I mean, not a bad thing. I mean, we're just, you know, we were waking up having coffee talking about this because we're a mom and pop organization.
Right.
I opened up.
That's the kind I like.
Yeah. Right,
the
mom and your parents would love us. I'm telling you, that's why we're moving to Astoria. I want to be in your parents' neighborhood. We'll start a communal garden together.
That's right.
It'll be great.
That's right.
And we'll each pick up a shift at the children's
community space
that you're building.
Fair enough.
I'll teach comedy. She'll do photography. I opened for James Brown and Ray Charles.
Oh, wow.
And the James Brown experience, I didn't want to meet him because he's such a hero of mine.
Mm.
But it was a great show. I'm glad I did it. It was at the Conocti Harbor Resort, which is like 2 hours north of San Francisco.
Yeah.
This is like 94, 95. Couldn't have been easier, more pleasant. The Ray Charles experience, I opened up for him at Tramps, this jazz club in New York City. Uh-huh. And nobody was there to see me. And, you know, I had to do 20 minutes. Everyone's chanting, Ray, Ray, Ray. That one was very tough. But I'm forever... I think those are two of the coolest things that I've ever done in my career. Now, yeah. My wife, her all-time favorite is Chuck Berry. And Chuck Berry is the seed that all of, you know, rock and roll grew out of, that and the blues. So,
yeah.
And then Smokey Robinson. I mean, you know, that was Bob Dylan's favorite singer. I mean, tell me about those experiences.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
Did you get to meet Chuck and hang out with him?
I met them both, man. Yeah. Yeah, we hung out all week. No, we didn't hang out. I met them backstage. And, no, but it was, again, it's that bizarre thing of here I am because I wrote some jokes.
With two American living legends.
Right?
Yeah.
It blows your mind. And for the Chuck Berry one, it was like it was one of those corporate gigs. It was like a convention of dentists in St. Louis at a, you know, convention center or something like that. So they just hired Chuck Berry, and then through my agent or whatever, I just got the gig. So, you know, I'm probably 30 years old or whatever I was. You know, I was good, but not great. But, you know, I just remember being like, am I dreaming? Like, Chuck Berry? Why am I doing a gig with Chuck Berry? Like, what went wrong? You know, like, you can't believe that you're sharing the stage with him. But the thing that I remember most about it is that he put on an amazing show and that his wife sat by the side of the stage and had the most kind of sweet bearing about her, just watching her husband. And I was like, do you watch him all the time? She's like, yeah, whenever I can, I like to watch him.
Wow.
You know, so that made it like a really big impression on me. Yeah. And then the Smokey Robinson one, he was just as nice as could be, you know? Like you say, a true legend. I mean, and watching him, you forget how many classic songs he wrote.
Yeah.
You know, because he sang all the ones that he wrote.
Tears of a Clown? Come on.
Tears of a Clown, like songs for I think the Four Tops or the Temptations, I can't remember. He wrote a lot of their tunes. He wrote a lot of the girl group tunes. Just so many great songs. And the consummate performer, but as lovely as could be off stage, and you know, it doesn't have to be nice to me,
yeah.
You know, but came by and said hello, thanked me for being on the show, all that. So yeah, man, like those kind of experiences, you know, you just kind of thank the universe for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Smokey Robinson is like a biblical figure. I think he's gonna live to be like 900, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the other thing. He looked amazing.
He looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. He still looks like he's 35.
He does.
That song, Cruisin', I think is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
So, well, that's beautiful, Ted. Do you, what joke have you written that you're the most proud of? Is it possible to narrow this down? Is that...
It's tough to say,
too,
man.
Too ephemeral of a question. I think the gay marriage... Well, then your abortion joke just... eclipse that.
I like those that drop the hammer. I do.
Jokes that change perspective, I think, are the best.
Yeah.
Or that you learn things from.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do like those. I like, I mean, I have one now that I'm doing that I really like about, I say, I don't like when people tell me that their baby is flirting with me. You know, like a baby will smile and the parent's like, oh, she's such a flirt. I'm like, I don't know how to tell you this, but I don't want to fuck your baby. You know, like, you know, like it's inappropriate of them to even suggest that. Because what if I was to be like, you know, I'm so glad you said that because I thought your baby was flirting with me. And I was like, am I crazy? Is this baby into me? So thank you for the green light with your baby. You know, so I mean, that's one that I like now.
That's beautiful. What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
I guess, you know, I learned a lot that the period that I worked with Louis he said, I guess the basic message, if I had to consolidate it, is just to trust yourself. And I'll explain that what he meant was, he said, like, when you come to the point in your set where you can go left or you can go right, and left is where all the laughs are, left's where the old material that you know kills is, or you can go right to the stuff that's not ready, you don't even really like it yet, but you know there's maybe something there. He's like, you have to keep going right. You have to put away the stuff that kills, put away, even shut off your brain, like, don't allow it. You're not allowed to go to that side. Go to the right, because it's going to be more interesting, it's going to be scarier, it's going to be more compelling and more worthwhile, you know? So I think that was probably, in a nutshell, the best advice that I don't always take, but I try to as much as I can.
Great advice. Well, especially for me right now where I am in the world. Ted, I'm a big fan. I love your work. I love you as a human being. I think you are one of my favorite comedians, I'd have to say, man. I mean, like I said, you know, you have this aura and air of artistic, well-rounded, peaceful, political-minded guy. And, you know, I really look up to you, man. So,
thank you, Tom. And I have to, I don't want to cut you off, but I've always felt a connection with you. Maybe it was the way you faked being a teacher. But no matter how it started, I always felt a warmth and a connection to you. So I'm so glad that this came to be.
Yeah, man. I'm really thrilled that we were in Minneapolis at the same time. And in closing, do you have any words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to give to the people of the earth?
Oh, man. Have I not given enough? Must I keep giving?
There's somebody out there listening in China.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's all very weird and beautiful, you know? That's what I think it all comes down to. You know, like you said, here we are in Minneapolis, you know? And, like, I first heard about you years ago, and now here we are. So it's, you know, I try to appreciate the bizarre beauty of connections is it love? Is it beauty? Is it whatever it is? It's the stuff that feeds us.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, Ted. I love you, man. Long may you run, brother.
You too, man.
Long may you run. All right. I want to meet your family.